Thanks for tuning in to Jin and Tantra. In this episode, we start out by discussing one of the obstacles that can totally derail your life, only then to be derailed by the spontaneity of the moment. We get into talking about the characters in our collective story, questioning the meaning of love and connection, Confucianism versus Taoism, the psychology of Carl Rogers, holding space and form for the expression of energy. Enjoy the episode. We definitely did.
Welcome to Jin and Tantra, spirituality with a twist. The podcast that takes Tantrism, Buddhism, Taoism, Sufism, Kabbalism, Shamanism, Chinese, Medicinism, and all of the other isms we've been influenced by, and blends them into a tall, crisp, cool cocktail your spirit has been longing for.
I want you to get together.
Now, isn't that refreshing?
I want you to get together.
Hey, fellow Juneteers, those of us who like our spirituality with a twist. So we have gone in different directions with these episodes recently. We had on Dr. Thies, we had on Phaedra Chantal, we had on some really great guests. And now we're going to double back to something that we had started a bit ago and will probably be an ongoing project. Mm-hmm. Also part of a little bit of a book project for Daniel and I, fingers crossed.
Fingers right? crossed. Toes also.
If you're out there, cross a bunch of stuff for us.
Yeah,
too.
Yeah, please. Yeah.
You figure out how to cross. If you're some great yogi, you can cross weird things, cross weird things too.
Yeah, exactly.
There's these Taoist nine obstacles, or our alternative title is nine things that, and we're going to go through them. We're going to cover them one by one in the episodes. And I guess as we're doing it, we're kind of writing a book, you know. It's a little bit of a shout out to Robert Thurman's alternative title to his latest book, which was Cheer the Fuck Up.
Yeah.
It's nine things that could fuck you up. And we did a couple of them already. So we're up to number three. Our first one was talking about insecurity,
mm-hmm.
excessive concerns about security. The second one was problems with, I guess you'd say, family of origin, right?
Yeah.
And now we're into problems with spouse and children. And, you know, Danny and I were talking before we flipped the recording on, and, you know, we have different takes on this, you know, and different parts of this to say. So I think it's like, it's great, you know, we'll share it with y'all. And in a certain sense, we're going to share it with one another too, because we've talked about these issues before a lot, obviously, but we haven't talked about exactly this. So for me, full confession, I could be in a slight darker place recording this episode because I feel a little bit of heartache. And yet, when I was thinking about it today, I thought, well, you know, I don't want to make like a pessimistic episode.
Mm.
I don't want to do that. And I didn't want to have the episode infused with some of my more, I don't know, the more immediate kind of heart-achy feelings that I might be feeling. I wanted to talk about this in a genuine way, in an optimistic way, but also in an honest way. Those three things, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of the genuine way also was like, to be honest about it, you know, not to say that this stuff is all wedding bells and wedding cake and things like that, because it absolutely isn't.
Mm-hmm.
I think to think that way is naive. So in part, like, I'm going to try to talk honest what I think about some of this stuff. But also, like, you know, it was important for me when I was thinking about it this morning. I texted some people about it. I had some conversations with people about it. And I was like, well, I don't want to do this in any way that is also pessimistic. So anyways, realistic, but also with some feelings of optimism.
Mm-hmm.
And when I was thinking about it in the morning, I was going, well, what's the optimistic part for me? When I looked at it honestly, also with maybe a sense of optimism, it was like, well, my positive realization was something like this. And I shared off you, Daniel, we've talked about this kind of thing before, but we revisit, and, you know, tell me what you think. For me, it was something like the idea, like, it's not the Tao's fault. I don't blame this on the Tao if these things don't work. Because I think in some way, the Tao is providing the opportunities for beautiful experiences between people. I think that's really true. I think there are very deep, beautiful, romantic, and spiritual bonds between people there in potentiality. I honestly believe that that's true. And thinking about that way, I thought, well, this is great, you know, to think this, you know, the ingredients mm-hmm. are kind of there out there in potentiality, right?
Yeah.
Maybe you just kind of like add the water and give it a stir or something, but the sure. ingredients are there for things. And that made me feel good, you know, that there's a certain beauty to this, right?
Yeah.
That there really are possibilities for these things. And it's like not even necessarily always that subtle. I think sometimes the Tao or the universe or the Buddhist goddesses will shout at people about this. Yeah, you know, we did the episodes on Carl Jung and it was like synchronicities and shouting of the universe, like this is an important person, recognize this, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
The positive part is that, you know, those possibilities are actually there. So in that sense, I felt like, okay, this is not the fault of the Tao. And that felt like the good news to me, the gospel of the good news.
Mm.
I felt like the fault, the downside of it to me is probably the fault seems more to be in the people. It seems to be an us, not in our stars. You know, I think the possibilities are there, but the fault is more in the people and maybe in the society that molds the people. So I still feel that way. But on the other hand, I feel like the possibilities are in the spiritual sense, in the metaphysical sense, in that sense there. So anyways, that feels like the positive to me. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah. Yeah, it does.
Yeah. I felt also like, I'll share it in the beginning because it was kind of interesting. I was thinking about the societal aspect of this and the people aspect, which is obviously one of my hot issues.
Eric, before you go there, let me add, because so you're referencing like the universe, the hand, the invisible hand that is, you know, writing the narrative of our individual and collective journeys, right? And not blaming the hand that is writing the story, but the characters that are within the story, right? This is what you're kind of saying.
I was going to say, like, as quote of the show for me, I was going to say, yes, the world is all merely a stage, but the script sucks.
Okay, so, okay.
So I would blame it more on the script than on the spiritual factors of people. I think there's something wrong. And I'll talk about more from a Taoist point of view.
Sure.
Now in this one. Finish your thought, though. I didn't mean to, like, you know.
No, you're good. I guess, like, the question comes into, like, mistakes.
Mm-hmm.
Like, where do you fall? Or what is your take on this idea of you know, mistakes or things that are done, you know, improperly and correctly? I guess you can look at like the ethical or moral code of the particular time that you're in, the laws that you're working around, but let's just go for right here, society, right now, in life, you know, because I think this is an important, in my mind anyways, it's an important delineation on what makes a particular time or a particular relationship more or less difficult is when we're operating within some paradigm that we could feel comfortable in. You know what I'm saying? And I think when we step outside of that it feels, it has emotionality or physicality that like, oh, that doesn't feel good, or this seems off or something like this. Is what I'm saying making sense to you?
Well, let me like go back and like, I'll get to the part that like hit me first and then maybe I'll ask you for a clarification on it.
Sure.
You know, to me, I don't know if there's like a magical invisible hand like guiding all the events or something. I don't know if I feel that way exactly.
Okay.
I'm always using that kind of poetically. You know what I mean? I do feel though that like, as opposed to maybe, you know, a theistic way of thinking.
Yeah.
Like there's some deity that's saying you belong with this person in this way or something. I don't think I think that way. Maybe I did at some point. I don't think I think that way anymore.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think it's quite clear that there are, you know, profound things in potentiality between people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and sometimes like very profound. And I probably would frame it a little bit more in a Buddhist-y kind of a way than I would have maybe at other points in my life, which is just that there's extreme energetic resonance and karma between people that really can be enlightening. So that was the part that jumped out at me from what you were saying.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if I think it's like the invisible hand is necessarily like arranging everything to optimize.
Right, yeah.
That way, but anyways, well, I mean, you had some other part of that
too. Yeah, so that was just, I was just reframing what you were saying, but I guess the idea is like, you know, because again, you're just talking about the people who are involved in it being more or less coherent with each other.
This is like a very personal take on this too. This is how I feel
personally. Yeah, no, for sure. And so I guess my question was like, how do you view what we would consider like mistakes, or do you not think that that's a thing? Like, is the unfolding of people's actions?
What kind of mistakes are we talking about?
You know, I don't know. Like, why, you know, or do things just go awry? Or are there behaviors that we engage in that cause them to be that way? Or is it a combination of both? I don't mean to make it dualistic, but I guess my question is looking at like, how much responsibility do we take in the things that don't unfold into what we would describe as good, you know, or beneficial for us in terms of relationships, right? Because you're talking about, you're having a little bit of heartache going through this kind of thing. We were talking before we started recording about people's actions and the ripple effects that it has around them. You know what I'm saying? And like, okay, so we look at that from an outside perspective and we could be like, well, this person didn't communicate that well enough. This person didn't think about their actions and what that would do to that other person. And now those two things aren't working out well. And now communication is off and people are separate. And so there's, you know, longing for the other person. It doesn't even have to be sexual. It could be friends too. You know what I'm saying? And so I'm looking to see what your thoughts are on the actions of particular of the participants in the story.
I don't know what to say about it totally. Like, the thing that gets me, and we might all have our own bugaboo things about these kinds of stuff. The thing that probably bugs me the most would be the failure to realize and develop potential. That bothers me a lot.
Okay.
So if I look at something being a mistake, I usually feel the mistake lies there. That the potential is kind of there, intrinsic in the situation. The alchemy could happen. The magic could occur, but people don't do it for various reasons, you know? And I suppose that's what really bothers me. Now, other things might bother other people, but that's my bugaboo issue.
Okay.
I don't know if you're talking about exactly that. You might be talking about something a little different. I don't know.
Maybe, but let me just finish. I'll just do the interviewer question. Who or what would you consider like potential at its highest expression? Because if someone doesn't live up to their potential, but if the relationship doesn't blossom to its potential, or like you said, someone is not up to that, like how do you view when it's something is for yourself? Obviously these are not like, you know, written anywhere, but like for yourself, how do you view that? You know, how do you view, oh, this seemed to have expressed itself.
I want to understand it, but I don't know if I'm totally getting, you're asking me something, but maybe it's not clicking for me.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe give me your take on it, and then I'll see if I can respond to your take.
Well, I'm just asking you about the potential part when you said, I will go back and do my thing, but I just wanted you to finish your thought. You're like, when things don't go to their full potential.
Well, I my experience would be more like, I think people, I think it's like the Carl Jung thing, if I go back to him. Like, mm-hmm. he was faced with the question of like, am I going to do things to bring things to some conclusion?
Mm.
That I'll have to take action, and I'll have to go through and make this happen. It's just like, I would also say the same thing about Rumi. These are the two inspiring people for me. And I think I bring Rumi up again a little bit later.
Mm-hmm.
So I wasn't sure we're going to talk about this, but I kind of look like the thing that bothers me is Shams of Tabriz shows up and Rumi goes, you know, it isn't working out. Timing's wrong, Shams. And, you know, there's people in the town won't really approve of it. And
I got it.
That drives me crazy.
Got it.
Like, we all have our own deals of what things will bother us.
Fine.
Know?
Yeah.
And then there's no poet Rumi.
I understand. Okay. Poems.
That's what bugs me.
I get what you're saying.
But that's personal. You know what I mean? Like, so I wouldn't say that's going to have to bother everybody, but that's the part that bugs me.
But, and that's what you mean by potential.
That's what I mean by potential.
Yeah. That's okay. That's fair enough.
Shams has potential. Rumi has potential. Those two things crack.
Right.
Come together into like explosive alchemical sparks,
mm-hmm.
that still raise it down to the present day. Cause I just listened to poems, you know, Coleman Barks doing his poems just the other day.
Yeah.
Get myself in the headspace of like, okay, yeah, I'm in, I'm still going to walk this journey of these feelings.
Yeah.
That's the part that bugs me. Now, again, listeners, and you know, you too, Daniel,
yeah.
You know, whatever bugs you in this, I suppose we all could have the things that bug us, but that part for some reason drives me up the wall. We've talked about it in the past. I think, anytime there's psycho-spiritual potential that doesn't get realized, that we have talked about, no matter what part of life it is, that drives me up the fucking wall.
Yeah.
Whether it's this part of life or some other part of life, that drives me crazy.
Yeah.
You know? So I have like a very high like sensitivity meter to like unrealized psycho-spiritual potential. It drives me nuts. difference. Mm-hmm. But, you know, again, different strokes for different folks. People have different feelings of what set them off. But this sets me off major, which is probably also why I love the stories of like Rumi and Shams, why I love that story so much. Because they like, I have like, I guess we're skipping around a little bit, but I want to do a follow-up Rumi episode at some point because I got some things to talk about. The fact that he did it, you know?
Yeah.
Rumi went through and like did the thing to realize what was ultimately an incredible interpersonal alchemy between two people. Obviously Shams did too.
Right.
It might have cost him his head. You know, he might have gotten killed over it, which, you know,
right.
that's a darker side of that story, obviously. Very dark. But, you know, that's the part that bugs me. So I don't know. Do you feel the same way? Or for what you were talking about, were you putting the emphasis on a different point?
I was putting the emphasis on a different point, but it got me to the same place.
Okay.
Which is what part about this do you view as the downside? And the downside for you is not, you know, so that's how I was saying mistakes, you know, but like really what I'm talking about is like obstacles to fruition. And that's what I'm asking is that like those things took a left when they maybe could have gone right or straight or,
now, in the
you
end,
know, whatever.
We all can recognize that everybody has their own choice and values of what they think is important. And you can't judge someone if like, well, that was something that was possible. Nah, I'm not into it.
Right. And that's
John showed up and Rumi said, you know, I'm not into him that much. Well, you can't really judge him on that.
Right. Right. And that's why I was asking you about the potential itself, because it's.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, but I understand what you're saying now, and hopefully, people do as well.
My experience of this was a little bit, you know, like I haven't had things in my life where it's been like I haven't had like unrequited love. That hasn't happened to me exactly.
Oh, lucky you.
That maybe haven't come to fruition, but I haven't had something where like this person doesn't have any feelings for me at all. So I haven't had that too much, you know? I mean, maybe in the end, the person wasn't into you and they dump you. But I haven't like had like I'm totally deluded, this person doesn't have any feelings for me at all. I haven't had that really,
right?
You know, not too much,
right?
You know, that just hasn't been part of my story. I'm trying to think of an example of that, and maybe I can't think of one. That's not because I'm like super awesome. I think I just have a radar for where there's something there. It's not like, well, I'm so great, everyone's gonna be super into me. No,
yeah, right. No.
It's more just like, okay, I think I know the people when there's something there.
Yeah, you feel it.
Person in my life, you feel it, and it usually is something like, I think this is mutual. But anyways, you know, for my point of view, I think that's what bothers me. But, you know, it is true. Things can be like, again, to use our example, if like Sham showed up and then Rumi was super interested into him, and then Sham's like, you know, I came to Konya to meet you, but this isn't really my thing.
Right.
You can't judge Shams.
Right. Right.
That's fair enough.
Well,
it's interesting. Okay, so. Go ahead.
No. I was going to say, since we're on the themes of like love and attachment and things like this, we could just move into the.
I did write Lama Glenn about this, so I thought I would share a little Lama Glenn about the social part.
Yeah.
Because I wrote him, and it was interesting because I think what he wrote back would echo things that you and I have talked about in the thought too. So I'm paraphrasing him, but he basically said, well, you know, I asked him like, here's some weird questions. I just said that. And then he wrote back and said, no, I don't think these questions are weird at all. And then he said,
what were some of the questions, Eric? So just so weird.
Well, I was basically asking, what do you think about this aspect of love and connection? And, you know, I threw that kind of broad.
Okay.
You know, but, you know, it was like something, how should I explain it? When you're reaching out to someone, he and I have talked about this before. I suppose I was asking him, like, I find myself feeling these connection. I feel a connection with someone that's very profound. I was asking about someone in particular. And so I just kind of sent it to him out of the blue. And I said, well, what do you think this means when you feel something this profound for some person? And I said, okay, I just titled the email. I put the heading like weird question, you know? And then he answered back kind of a big thing. And I threw out some things in about society and relationship in there too, you know, my things that concern me. And he said, you know, this wasn't a weird question at all. He wrote back, which was cool. You know?
Yeah.
And then he said, he said, my own theory on this is it has something to do with karma. On the social front, he said, we have all had previous lives in different social systems, which we may have kind of internalized. And that's something I think we've talked about too.
Yeah.
I think I realized that more in the process of doing the podcast over the time that we've been doing it. You know, people, if you've grown up in America, lifetime after lifetime after lifetime, reincarnated here, American things seem very natural to you, right? And very true. And if you haven't, then they don't seem that natural to you anymore. That's struck me as kind of pretty a profound point, you know?
Mm.
And then he said, you know, then we carry those impulses forward. And then this leads to however you feel about love and relationship.
Sure.
However you feel about who you feel connection with. And I was like, yeah, I'm in on that. You know, I wrote him back and he didn't write me back. And I'm not sure why. Maybe he just got busy, you know. But I wrote him back and they said, you know what I really want ultimately, because he was talking about like different sociocultural settings and even how Buddhist philosophers have talked about this and stuff like that. And I said, well, if I really think about it honestly for myself, I want like sometimes what you would call like the Dakini land effect. In Tibetan Buddhist Tantra, they have this idea that there's realms where all people do is work on enlightenment. And every single aspect of every experience is just an experience working on enlightenment. Whether it's love or it's sex or it's, you know, all the other aspects of life, that's the Dakini realm idea. Every single part is a gesture and an action that is supposed to be helping all parties go to enlightenment.
Mm-hmm.
And I realized like in the end, more so than anything, I was just writing it back that this is what I want. I want to live in a life where that's the ultimate thing. You know, all the things go to that place.
Right.
You know? And I kind of wrote it in the context of like the pure Dakini land ideal or something like that, you know? You know, all the ingredients are there. And I feel like all the ingredients are kind of there even in our little realm of the world to do that. But I don't know if it really happens when it should or could. And that I find kind of tragic, I suppose.
Mm.
But again, I also recognize people have their individual choices and they're going to make the decisions that they're going to make based on what seems best to them. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But I know, how do you feel about the Dakini land idea? I mean, like this, I guess there's some part of me that like very deeply resonates with me, this idea like, well, let's go to a place where everything is directed towards enlightenment, no matter what it is, you know?
Yeah, I mean,
that's where I want to live. That makes sense.
So I think, you know, as all things, there's the relative level and the absolute level. On the absolute level, maybe there is a place that is like that, mm-hmm. right? And on the relative level, I think that is the goal of practitioners, right? That is the goal for us to do, is to have all activities, mundane and otherwise, be expressions or be emanations or expressions of the movement towards enlightenment. And so, you know, again, we've said it numerous times, but taking life as one's teacher, this is what it's meant by that. It's not necessarily that life is a being that is teaching you, but as the expression of life is the movement towards enlightenment, and all the fodder that goes into the fire is part of that. So like people who take yoga classes, if you have a decent enough teacher, they'll say you should take your yoga off the mat. Well, yeah, they're saying, you know, be mindful about how you move your body in space. Of course, be good to yourself, be aware of how you're breathing, but yoga is union. You know, you're melding two things together. You're melding your mind and your body in one. You're being aware of how you're moving together, but you are trying to transcend duality. You know, at least the localized duality of brain and body is two different things. Taking that off the mat is again transcendence of duality. And so in this case, you know, it's tantra, right? The deeper layer of tantra is not what you do, but how you do it. So living life as a whatever, a janitor or as a professor or, you know, whatever, you're perfecting those, you know, you're using your wisdom of tantra, you know, it's how you do things, and putting that into the means of your daily basis, using whatever you're doing as now a perfection of yourself, as a perfection of whatever you want it to be, as the intention that you have behind it. You know what I'm saying? So I think on a relative level, that makes absolute sense. And if I can say it, I mean, I think you do a good job of that already. You know what I mean?
That's nice to say. One does the best one can. You too, yeah. Right?
I mean,
try to do the best we can in these things.
You know, traveling in cars, we probably listen to a little bit too much sports radio, which is not exactly enlightenment material.
I wore that off.
Yeah, no, I have too.
Caleb Williams, which is a big deal, I guess. So, you know, whatever. Yeah.
Whatever it is. But, we're not perfect beings. We're Bears fans. So you guys got to give us a break, right? You know, like it's just.
I have a soft spot for these really bad mystery audiobooks.
Okay. Well, you know, but so I, you know, but there's some karma there. So Lama Glenn would give us an out. But so that's on one hand. And then on the other hand, what else do I think about it is that like when you were describing it, I had a very beautiful visual inside of my mind while you were talking. So I was playing, you know, like paying attention, but then playing this image in my mind naturally. And then I heard in my head, you can't understand duality from a localized perspective, or you can't understand non-duality from a localized perspective. So, you know, which is like, okay, sorry, you know, I'm doing too many things at once, but it was a very lovely image that I had in my head. So thank you for sharing that.
I think like it's beautiful. I think that the writing the Lama Glenn thing, because I had kind of sat on it for a while. I hadn't asked him these questions. And I wanted to ask him about, you know, like a particular set of experiences I'm going through, right?
Sure.
But also, you know, just more in general, like, what do you think of this whole thing? You know?
Yeah.
And is it the value or not value? I guess in part, I was asking him, like, should I question this in myself or should I not question this in myself? You know, are these character traits that are good for me or bad for me?
Right.
You know? So I threw these questions at him, you know, and then so he wrote back what I thought was a good answer. And there was even like, when I doubled back on the email he sent me, I said, you know, it is interesting. Like when you pose a question to, you know, a spiritual teacher, a spiritual teacher and friend, he always talks about us being friends. You know?
Yeah.
So a spiritual teacher and friend, Dharma friend, something does kick in that's kind of interesting.
Mm.
Like there's almost like a connection to the whole lineage maybe kicks in some subtle way, or all the way back to, you know, the source of the lineage in some ways. You know, something happens because it was healing somehow, even beyond the words that he said.
Yeah.
I could feel that things started to clarify in me. And I mean, that was just interesting in and of itself, the connection to another person, you know?
Yeah. And going a little meta here. I mean, you know, if legitimately, you know, we don't have such a huge audience, you know, a couple hundred thousand people, it's not that big. But, you know, just trying to put the words to it, you know, but if people have legitimate questions about stuff, like feel free to send to Eric or I, you know, we really enjoy these kinds of conversations. You know, I think there's a lot of content and material that's out there in general that are conversational, that are, they're, I don't know how to say it, contemporary in terms of topics that are up, you know, in the news, or this person said this about that, or their sports, or, you know, whatever the case is. But you know, we do those as they come natural, and usually it's me, you know. He was like, all right, pause programming, gotta get something out, you know, but in a respectful way, you know. But we would certainly love to, if people had questions or just wanted a different perspective, we would definitely, you know, entertain all of the thoughts that you had about, you know, things in particular. So please feel free to email us. And the email is better to send those kinds of questions, jinandtantra@gmail.com. Or, you know, you could do a message on Instagram, the Jin and Tantra podcast. So you can feel free to do that there. And we'll definitely, one of us or both of us, we'll get back to you.
That's an email probably in the end anyways. But yeah, if you want to make the initial connection that way, right?
Yeah. 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 So just to kind of say that, and that, like, these are conversations that Eric and I are having live, you know, so this is not, you know, we kind of have an idea what we're going to discuss, but like at this point, we're really off of where we wanted to go, but it's all good. We'll get back to that, whatever. But, you know, these are live conversations as we're processing the things that we're going to and providing or sharing the things that were given to us that were valuable, like Eric's, you know, conversation or, you know, emails back and forth with Lama Gun, in that, like, yeah, the words have value. But I know there's somebody who went with me to Mexico, and, you know, on retreat. And when she came home, she said that, she, you know, in order to, you know, kind of like, she felt a little off getting back into society for a little while, just because you're so energetically open when you're on spiritual retreat, and coming back into like shapes and forms and deadlines and bosses and employees and everything else. She listened to the podcast like every day. Just to kind of put herself back into a place where she could contemplate non-mundane things, think about the spiritual aspects of regular life. And she just shared this with me yesterday, actually, because I just saw her yesterday. And so
that makes me really happy. That's wonderful.
Yeah. Yeah. So I wanted to share that with you, because it's probably not just the words. You know what I'm saying? It's probably not just the words. And so, you know, in the moments we try and be meticulous about how we share things and with the language that we're using. But I can say for those who this resonates with, you know, the intentionality behind what it is that we're doing and saying really does come from a very deep place. And this is an open and honest space. It's almost like a confessional. Forgive me, Father, for I have sinned. I have sinned it again.
Well, I think like what I was trying to get to was talking about confessional. What I was trying to get to with Lama Glenn was a description of what like is ultimately kind of like a very deep kind of longing.
Sure.
The longing to find people who are spiritual soulmates or something like that. Mm. That's probably the deepest longing I have.
Yeah.
You know, and in the rare eventuality that it happens, it's very powerful for me. But, you know, kind of like the Shams story, you know, of Shams and Rumi, you don't know where the lightning is going to strike.
Or when.
Strike in the most convenient of places, you know? And so then it's the question of like, do you make the thing happen, even though it might not be the most convenient of things? Do you figure out between the people involved, the two of you involved, like how you make something work, even though it might not be, you know, the most obvious or easy thing? Certainly, future ain't easy for Rumi and Shams at all. Like
right.
That shit. Yeah, but they did that. And so like there's some part of me that I think is very important. On the one hand, I feel like, I guess what I was trying to get to with the Tao was, I feel like from that side, those possibilities are there. I was putting it under the framework of like gifts of the Tao.
Okay.
What a way to frame it, you know, not like the Tao is sitting there going like, who should I match so-and-so with? Not like
right.
that. Then the general flow of what the possibilities are, there are possibilities there between people that could be really beautiful.
Yeah.
I have the Taoist attitude back with it then that, you know, I'll have it later on in the notes, but energy before form. Don't let the form kill the energy. Let the energy kind of dominate the thing and then figure out the form off the energy.
Sure.
A lot of it goes reverse.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I suppose for me, if you want to go into the next thing, you got something more you want to say about that? I want to move it along if you had something.
That's an interesting thing. I mean, that's a really deep question. And I think it's one, yeah, that will open up this a little bit further. I don't know what's more or less right. I mean, I think it depends on what you want. If you have a certain desire for your life, right, that you feel strongly about, you know, a certain passion that you're pursuing or something like this, then things that come up are things that come up, you know, and they're there for you for a reason or for a season. But back to the earlier part, like what is the full expression of that particular thing? I don't know. But if you have your own trajectory that you are working on, then taking a you know, what do you want to call it? Like a side journey, if you will, you know, maybe that's part of it, or maybe that's what it's supposed, maybe that's all of it. And that's what it's supposed to be. I don't know.
You have a thing about energy before form, because that's Zen. Like that's a fundamental Zen concept, energy before form. Like Chosenji, where I was studying Zen, that's like a dictum.
Yeah.
That's like a Newton's law, you know? You know, it's like the fourth Newton's law or something. So
right.
How do you feel about that?
In terms of guiding one's decisions?
Do you feel like that's a principle for you, or do you feel like you don't resonate with that as a principle?
I do and I don't. I mean, I do for sure, but I mean, in that sense, energy is a kind of ambiguous term. Because if you have, you know, what energy, so then where does one's will come into play? You know what I'm saying? Versus where does one's desire come into play? Versus how does the creative interaction between both of those things come into play? Because it would seem to me that those two things might not always fit, you know, especially in relational terms, relationship terms, especially when it's juicy, it's probably complicated, you know?
So I know maybe it's totally fine. We might just think about it differently. You know, for me,
yeah.
I sort of think what there is in potentiality between people
mm-hmm.
is like, is when it's good, meaningful, edifying.
Yeah.
Profound.
Yeah.
Transformative.
Alchemically yeah.
Significant. That's kind of a something to be treasured.
Yes, I agree.
That is, you know, that's the energy.
Mm-hmm.
In a certain sense, you can't entirely will that, maybe.
That's sure.
Something that's sort of there between two people with a kind of a spontaneity.
Yeah.
No?
Yeah, yeah.
So I'd say that's, in that situation, it's the energy. Mm-hmm. But the whole thing is probably based on some idea that's Taoist or Zen, you know, especially, which is that there is a way of moving through situations that is like capturing the possibilities of the essence of what is there.
Mm-hmm.
Part of doing Zen or Taoism is to recognize those things and take action upon them. But mm-hmm. other people have to feel that way.
Yeah.
But that's kind of the energy before form idea.
Sure.
The contrast, well, maybe we'll talk about it and we'll see what you think. Mm-hmm. Okay. So I was thinking a lot about Confucianism and Taoism, mm-hmm. right? I'm teaching a class where this thing comes up. And it's very interesting. I've been looking at it kind of closely. I was looking at like the I Ching.
You know, and the I Ching, for those who are unfamiliar?
Yeah, I was just going to do it.
Okay.
You made me do it.
You got it. Okay, good.
The I Ching is like this great old Chinese book where they try to describe patterns of change in the world. Mm-hmm. That could be in nature. It could be in your human life. It could be in society. Just patterns of change in terms mm-hmm. of like Chinese philosophy of yin and yang. But it's also a book you can use sort of for advice and almost like an oracle thing. You know, like they have all like traditional cultures across Asia, you know, where you can kind of either, you know, there's different methods of doing it, but the method I would probably do more would be you sort of throw these coins and the coins tell you what the yin and yang lines are. So you meditate on your problem. Should I quit my job? The coins, and the coins will have a certain pattern of yin and yang. And then you open the book and then you read through what the advice would be for someone going through that situation.
It's like the original magic eight ball.
Something like that. Something like that. Except Confucius commented on it.
Right, yeah.
I don't know if Confucius made a comment on the magic eight ball.
I don't know. But that might be a super old reference now that I think about it, Eric, you know, because I don't know if most people even know what that is.
Gen Zers know who that is, too.
Gen Zers know what a magic eight ball is?
Yeah, they do. Yeah.
Okay, I hope so. If not, yeah, I guess y'all can...
My daughter had one as a Gen Zer. She had
okay, fine. All right, that's cool.
It's all good. It's all good.
Okay, all right.
My son has gone around and gone like, does Sherry like me? And then the thing will pop up, you know?
Yeah.
Even in like second grade.
Okay.
As far as the love thing goes.
Yeah.
So it's really on like multiple levels. It never really tells you, the Chinese ones are interesting. It never tells you like, your boss sucks, quit your job. That's never Confucius's answer. It's never that blunt. I was kind of joke about it. It usually says more like, a fox tries to cross a great river. It gets his tail wet. Is that auspicious? ? And you're like, what the fuck are they talking about? Does stuff like that. It's like Chinese poetry, you know?
Yeah.
And they're long and kind of abstract. But anyways, you know, people give commentaries and you can kind of read it for advice about your life. And it's fun actually on some level. So I was looking at the I Ching but you know, it's very Confucian. And I realized like, a lot of the stuff that they'll give the answers has to do with like propriety. And, you know, they're very Confucian answers, which I have to figure out, like, I have to explain what that kind of means in the context of our conversation. So the deal is from the Confucian side, I was looking at things like the I Ching, and Confucianism says something like the solution to things is to set up structure and order and rules and responsibilities and codes, and then tell people that it's virtuous to fill these things, to fulfill these things. That's the Confucian position.
Mm-hmm.
That's how you put a society together. You create these social roles and make them in some way that they fit together, right? And then you make people go into those roles.
Right.
And that's how it's supposed to work. I mean, that's Confucianism in a nutshell, right?
Right. Form before energy, for sure.
Yes. And with good intent. So I'm not trying to say the intent is good. You know, the intent is good. I think Confucian was like, our society's fucked. We got to clean this shit up. Mm-hmm. I'm going to try to come up with a way of a system that will put things into a more orderly state and make it better. But you know, obviously it's something where we're going to structure the shit out of this thing. Mm. And you're going to go here and you're going to go there. And the middle sister's going to go over here. And the younger sister's going to go over here. And the older brother goes over here. And everyone does their shit. And if you all do your shit, then this should work. And if you don't want to do your shit, that's not virtuous.
Right.
Virtuous is you do the shit.
We will shame you.
Yes, we will definitely feel bad about it. And if you throw the I Ching, you might get a nasty comment from the I Ching about the fact that you're not keeping your duties. And I realized, like, oh, that's so funny. That book is so Confucian. And maybe when I first started working with it years ago when I was a TCM, Chinese medical student,
yeah,
in grad school, I don't know if it jumped out at me so strongly that way, but now it really does. on the other hand, I was like contrasting this with like some of the Taoist people, like Chuang Tzu is the really famous one. Well, he's come up in episodes here and there. He's really famous for the, I was asleep and I dreamt I was a butterfly. I woke up, I'm a person. Wait a minute, am I a person who dreamt they were a butterfly, or am I a butterfly now dreaming they're a person? You know, he writes these very beautiful poetical kind of things like that. That's probably his most famous thing. But it really struck me like how Taoism and Confucian, like Confucianism kind of grew up together. Because the Taoist thing is very much like, no,
right,
don't do that. That's really bad. And what you have to do is let more the natural flow events, let what the Tao and the universe is providing before you be the guide. Don't try to force things into these artificialities of form, because that's just going to be really, really bad, you know? And relative to what we're talking about now, I guess I would say, and what I was trying to say earlier, if it wasn't clear, that's bad on me. But the things that happen between people that are very, very deep, like a Rumi and a Shams, if they're the two characters for our episode, right, is just, you know, part of this gift, and, you know, has to be allowed to sort of naturally express itself. But, you know, it's interesting because it's the two sides of Chinese culture and they kind of clash, you know, and, you know, it's very interesting. Like there's this thing, and I guess I've always been pretty sensitized to that point, you know, being around this for so long, but it's crystallizing even more to me, like how much they kind of like are like feeding off. I'm like knocking my fists together here to show them kind of like clashing with one another, but they kind of clash and then they kind of like ricochet off one another into the positions that they take. And maybe it's one of those things that each individual person listening can decide for themselves, but I'm definitely more on the Taoist side of things.
Right.
I lean more in that way. It's not like I don't see that there's value in the Confucian thing, but I definitely lean more to the Taoist side. And I suppose, you know, if I had a gripe, my gripe would be what I was trying to talk about earlier. Rumi and Shams show up, but, you know, Rumi doesn't get to be Rumi and Shams doesn't get to be Shams because they're not the proper positions in terms of the Confucian propriety of the society that they're in. Like, I don't like that thing. But anyways, that's, you know, I've just been thinking about that a lot. And so, you know, that's sort of how it's framing itself for me. The way it frames myself for me personally is like, if you're lucky enough to find people that you have deep spiritual interconnection with, it should be appreciated and valued, and don't let the Confucianists get in the way. But that's my vibe. You know, I know, how do you feel about that? We haven't talked about exactly this issue. So I was writing it up, you know, for my part of the notes. And I was like, I want to bounce this off of Daniel because I don't really know what you think about it. And, you know, you might feel very different than me.
Yeah. So I think, you know, we started the conversation talking about, or maybe, I don't know if we did it on air or if we did it before we started. And we say on air, but I don't even know what that even refers to. Like we're at an oxygen bar smoking air, you know, but before we're going live, that there is inherited social tendencies that people have that, you know, yeah, we're talking about, because you mentioned with
Lama, like Glenn. Karmically, right? Like Lama Glenn's thing.
Yeah, exactly. That like we have these impulses that are in us, that are within us, that cause us to act in particular ways. And I am definitely like, I think the term Obama really kind of messed up the term community organizer, you know, because then you just have some like weird, and no one knows what that even means. Like, what does that even mean? I'm a community organizer, you know.
He used to run for president and then make a bunch of money afterwards, perhaps.
Yeah. I mean, I'm okay with that, you know. If that's the route, all right, let's do it.
I'm a little like, I'm a lefty person, and Obama, there's ups and downs to him.
Yeah, for sure, but he's. But when you think of the term community organizer, I mean, he's the only one that comes to my mind.
Yeah, that's true.
It's other than that, no one else, you know, you know what I'm saying? Like, but as somebody who hosts a lot of public events and does retreats and stuff like that, I consider myself this. And I also have a large number of communities that I am, I'm not going to say in charge of, that's the wrong thing, but, you know, I'm a facilitator of, a co-facilitator of, if you will, you know, because it takes people, you know. And so, but this is a very natural thing for me, you know what I'm saying? And much like you have been expressing this, what you expressed today was like all of the podcasts last year combined in like a, you know, 12-minute
subject matter came up again, right?
Yeah, so, for sure. But that's your thing. It's like, you know, you can't put a square peg into a round hole unless you smash that motherfucker in there, you know, and you don't like the feeling of smashing it in there. Like that just doesn't seem to be good. You know, you can do it, but like, Why?
Might you know, be a little sore in the morning.
That's right. On both sides.
Yeah.
But then
do you feel more of the emphasis on the form side? Because this has come up before. You sometimes have a little bit of a Confucian thing. I don't want to put words in your mouth, you know what I mean? Or, you know, impose ideas upon you. But I think you talked about the experience of being in Iraq and seeing chaos.
Well,
and having concern about like the chaotic qualities of things, which is a kind of a Confucian concern.
Yeah, I'll get there in just in
oh,
one.
Sorry. Okay.
No, you're good, brother. So as an organizer of, you know, of these kind of like communities and events and keeping them going for a long time, I totally recognize the importance of the relationships. But, you know, I value them extremely highly. Like they are important to me. Like when my mom came on the podcast, you know, some years ago at this point, you know, one of the lines I remember her saying is that, like, she's like, where I'm from in this culture, it's not me, it's we. And I definitely, even though like I cultivate and spend a lot of time cultivating relationships and community, it is about the collective in this case, you know, and the energy that gets infused comes back around and you have these kind of, so I'm very conscious of and grateful for the relationships that I have with all the various parties who come into my life, who are there for more than just a season, you know what I'm saying? But really for a reason. And so to your question, that was the answer to that. That's the answer to that part of that question. So definitely
that's like the appreciation of the energy between people. That's yes. The energy part for you. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, I get it. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's definitely it, you know? And then in terms of like the Confucian or the Taoist, the Taoism, I would like to think that I'm a more of a Taoist in this way, but like, I'm also, I don't want to say a realist, but I am, you know? And so I'm like, you could try and be a free flowing thing, but on some level, I think it's easier to do that when you have some boundaries somewhere, and makes one like, you know, it makes you feel a little bit safer, you know, for the example that I'll give is like, you know, being in a healing ceremony or something like this, you know, like, you know, that there's somebody else who is guiding you, you know, in this way. And so you get to, you can be relaxed, or being in a treatment room or having a good talk with a friend. You know what I'm saying? Or a therapist, if you can, you know, afford that thing. The rest of us broke folk got friends. You know what I'm saying? So, but you know, someone who's holding space for you, you feel, at least my interpretation, I'm being on both sides, you feel like you can express yourself and that it's going to be held properly. You're not going to be judged, you know, and what you say, you can kind of, you know what I'm saying? And so there's this, that and that, but that in a nutshell is that's the Confucianism part. That's the, it provides the boundaries for people to be free within. And I realize there's still a boundary there, but like, to me, this is how I experience it. And for me,
it's interesting for me. Cause like, if I think of myself as a clinician, I don't feel like if I'm in a clinical space with someone, I don't feel that to be like a Confucian space. I don't feel it. If someone's like opening up their heart and opening up their mind and sharing something, that doesn't feel like a Confucian space to me. I'm not saying that's a wrong way to think about it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just giving my own subjective feeling of it. That doesn't feel Confucian to me.
It sure.
Feels different. It feels more, I guess it feels more Taoist.
Sure.
Almost the way, like if we go to our favorite psychologists, Carl Jung and Carl Rogers, it feels Carl Rogers-y to me.
So you know
what I mean? Like that's the space that creates openness.
Sure.
The fact that there's a container that the room is in or something, that that's part of the privacy of the event or something to create that.
Mm-hmm.
But that doesn't seem, maybe I just think about this differently, and we all can.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That doesn't feel like the Confucian thing to me. So, but you know, different structure, different folks.
Yeah, I mean, for me, that it's the shape of the room. It's the unspoken or maybe even spoken rules of engagement that we have with our patients or our friends, that they can open up to be able to do that. Because you are there,
mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying? Because you're willing to listen, in a non-judgment. So all of these are like,
I'm cutting you off.
No.
Sorry.
Yeah. So all these are like unspoken rules of a good practitioner or of a good clinician or of a good friend, you know, or of a good family member, of a good partner in a relationship, you know what I'm saying? That you can do the heart opening aspect. You can do the mind opening aspect, and that it will be held and reflected in a compassionate kind of a way. But without someone else there, you're talking to yourself. You know what I'm saying? Like, you know what I mean? And so for me, it's, I view it as a safe, kind of like a safe space in a way that like you can work within, but it's not confining. It's just that like the nervous system, and I'll be a little bit physiological. The nervous system can release because there is not a threat. You know what I'm saying? You're providing a non-threatening space for someone to like really let go and relax and be held in. It's a place of the embodiment of having faith, maybe.
Dude, this struck interesting about that to me. This episode went all kinds of weird ways that
for sure. Expected. That's how you know. That's how you know there's some things that are off in life. You know what I mean?
Well, the thing that like strikes me about all of that is when I think about the Confucian side of things, I think of that as intrinsically more judgmental.
Mm.
Because in the Confucian world, there's nothing to ask about. It's very clear how you have to be. So you don't even have to ask, you know? There's no conversation to have. That's, to my mind, the Confucian problem.
Mm-hmm.
You got to go talk with your friend. Let me talk through things. There's nothing to talk about. What are you supposed to do? Those are your duties and responsibilities. This is already answered.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you don't have to go ask your Catholic priest what you're supposed to do about things. You pretty much already know.
Right. Know? Right.
You want to hear him say it again, you can hear it again, but it's pretty clear. Or, you know, the same with the Confucianism thing. You know, it's a lot, and that you probably will be made to feel guilty.
Sure.
If you're not like, if you're not on plan, if you're not on program, you're going to feel guilty. We're going to make you feel shame and guilt because you're not with the program. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You're not on script. Right.
Yeah.
And so that's, so maybe that's again, different ways that we think about this, but yeah. You know, I was like, that's what I would hear. I would hear. Yeah. The Confucian person is going to be like, no, I am going to judge you right now. You're wrong. This is not going to be a safe space. This is going to be a space where I'm going to tell you what you're supposed to do.
Yeah.
And that's what Confucius said.
Yeah.
If you're not doing that, you're wrong.
Yeah.
So that's our safe space. Congratulations.
Yeah. Congratulations. See you next
time. Shake of hands. Come back later if you have any more problems or questions. We'll make sure that we solve that for you. And you'll walk all the way with a big heap and load of shame and guilt along the way.
Yeah. It is. Yeah.
You know what I mean?
I'm wondering. I'm wondering. You know, I don't consciously try to shame or guilt. For sure, I don't. But on the
Daniel, I don't think you do at all.
I don't think I do. But I can say I definitely try and empower people. You know, and some of that empowerment for me comes through responsibility. Mm-hmm. You know, so like for example, somebody comes in and a friend has an issue. You know, and like you and I, we're herbalists, we're acupuncturists, we'll use cupping or whatever, tway knot, whatever tool we have. But if somebody is being hampered by the alcohol they drink on a regular basis, the negative behavior with a certain person in their life that is, you know, causing them stress, or the food that they're taking in, or too much exercise, not enough exercise, what the job, all the things that we talk about on this show, I can only move the needle so much regardless of how amazing I may or may not be. You know, herbs can only do so much, because in the tradition, those interventions are further down on the rung. It's like meditation, qigong, tai chi, lifestyle, spending time outside. This is what makes the change first. If by the time I have to get involved, now I got to stick sharp objects into you to, like, you know, get the stuff really moving. And so there is an aspect, not necessarily of like shame or guilt or judgment on my part, but I can definitely feel that like I want to empower people through showing them behaviors that they may be exhibiting that, from a practitioner standpoint, I could say, I don't think that's healthy for you, you know, or I don't know if that particular thing that you really love is that good for you. You know, you can't have that much cheese. It's not good for you. You know what I'm saying? Like, your nose is running all the time. It's not that great for you. You know what I mean? I know that sucks, but like, that is what it is. But I could totally see why I'm saying this is that, like, I could also totally see how someone might view that as judgmental or something else this way. And so even though I'm on the Taoist side of things and the Confucianism, it's not necessarily the philosophy that matters to me. It's the fact that like there is a place where we're in right now that is kind of like a sacred space of expression and of connection. And then once we leave that, it's not the same as it was when we were here. The implementation of that Confucian, the principles stop there. It is no longer, I don't use any you shoulds, you know, it just, this would be helpful for. And I say that because I have a desire to help. And I imagine that many people do. It's probably the clinician in me, but it could also be part of the male species. You know, we want to fix things. You know, I think that's, you know what I'm saying? So
I want to fix things too.
I'm sure they're probably going to do it a better job than I am.
I grew up with my mom. She wanted to fix a bunch of shit, whether it was successful or not.
Okay, know? There we go. So I just, but anyways. I'm glad that we did this because I feel like there are lots of people who would like, who see things wrong and would like to fix them and to feel that they can do that, but also to be mindful in the way of how they approach it. Because you can totally come off as shaming and blaming, even if you don't necessarily mean to be.
You know, it's interesting for me in that is I've had a couple of conversations, you know, like today even, about like Carl Rogers. He's come up a couple of times. He came up in a class I was teaching. So this is one of the great psychologists of the 20th century. And
yeah,
and one of our people that we go to periodically when he's relevant. And so he has those three principles of how you interact with people, right?
Yeah.
And so what's interesting to me is I see him being more Taoist for sure. You know, he did spend time in China. We had requests at one point to do a little bit more bio episodes on some of the psych people, you know, I think.
Yeah.
And so, you know, we'll try to get back to that at some point, you know?
Yeah.
But, you know, he did go to China and came back a different person. You know, he changed his mind in China. He was going to go do first ministry. And, you know, he came back and was like, no, I'm going to do something different. And also he became, I think, is this great psychologist. Mm-hmm. I mean, not just me, he's recognized great psychologist, mm-hmm. but one that I particularly love. And so he says, you know, the thing that works in the encounter, which what is what I hear and what you're describing to me, is first there's a space of like non-judgments and acceptance of the person.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes he uses terminology, unconditional positive regard.
Mm.
That's what he says. But, you know, it's kind of like an acceptance in a non-judgmental way. I'm not going to judge you, you know? And I think you're describing a space that's very non-judgmental. So I would say Rogerian then, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then one that's empathetic and understanding.
Mm-hmm.
You know, not just, you know, like not just sympathy, I'm going to feel bad for you, but like, no, I'm going to really try to understand you. I'm going to try to understand your perspective and do it from a empathetic point of view, looking mm-hmm. at it from sort of your side. And I think you're describing that too, which to me feels more Zen or Taoist to me.
Mm-hmm.
We all have our own definitions on these things.
Yeah, it's kind of
interesting. I hadn't thought about these things. Then the last one he brings up, he uses the word congruence, which what he really means is like honesty and authenticity. Right. I think that's what I hear in the, just real quick, sorry. That's what I hear in the end of it. I hear like, listen, I've heard you out.
Yeah.
You have a problem that you're smoking too much weed. So
yeah.
Let's just be honest about that part.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And I'm coming at this from a place, not that I'm judging you. And I'm not coming from a place where I'm not being understanding of even why you're doing that. I do understand, but let's be honest about this. And so I see that all still fitting under that same rubric. So again, different definitions for different people, but I feel like it's kind of a Taoist or Zen space.
Okay. You know what
I
mean? Yeah.
So, but I mean, that's how it resonates.
Sure.
I think it's interesting how it feels, you know, like, I guess I have some feeling about that.
Sure.
Like that feels open to me, what you were describing. That didn't feel closed or rigid to me. That felt very open. And then that's because I know you too. And I know you're a non-judgmental person,
but it's
for sure.
You know, but we're always you know, and I mean, I think it has value for people because we're always interacting. We're constantly interacting. I mean, that's all we do all day long is interact with people for the most part. I mean, if you have a technical job where you're putting numbers in or whatever, but you got to present those numbers to somebody at some point, you know, you have a family or friends, hopefully, God willing. Right. But there's that inherently in that means that you're exchanging words, you're exchanging energies, you're exchanging thoughts, ideas, emotions, all this other kind of stuff. And how do you do that? How do you present it? You know, I know we're kind of coming to the ending of our time tonight, but in the beginning we talked about the tantric view of things, right? It's not what you do, but how you do it. And so in this kind of like discussion on, you know, between practitioners, essentially, we're also just people having interactions. And yes, we have some education and some skill set and some experience dealing with people, but it's still fresh every time. You know, everybody presents new energies, there's new influences and whatever. And to be aware of in which how we interact with people and the places that we're coming from, I think is infinitely valuable, because that influences the way in which the world is connected, the network, you know, that pulls people together. So it's right now it's you and me. But when we finish this show, it's me and my partner and you and your son and you and your partner. And then, you know, we get a phone call from a friend, and then it's you and your daughter, or you and your buddy, and me and me and a friend, and you and a client, and you and some students, and, you know, like, it's, and then they have their, like, it goes, it ripples constantly, you know. And I just, like, I'm enjoying having this conversation about that, because I think it makes the quality of the connection that we have with people better, higher, more deep.
That's kind of like the rippling effect of interconnectivity from some Buddhist point of view, right?
Yeah.
It creates interconnectivity in a very practical way.
Yes.
Not like in a metaphysical. That's also true. Things can be mystically entangled in the universe.
Sure.
That's cool. This is much more of like a practical kind of like, okay, this is going to interconnect.
Mm-hmm. Right? Mm-hmm.
When you talk about structure, I'm doubling back a little bit. But when you talk about structure, okay, you can have some structure. Like, we both like music. You need a little structure to have the music go.
Yeah.
Right? If there's no structure at all, that's not quite right. But the energy has to be the thing that leads.
Yeah.
And maybe it's because I did so much Zen at the beginning. There might be like a cultivation of a feeling. I haven't thought about this before. I'm just like, you know, just talking about it. But, you know, the whole idea that like cultivates a certain feeling of what feels natural,
mm-hmm.
you know, which is a kind of one of your favorite words we were talking about earlier, spontaneous, natural, unforced, you know.
Yes.
And the thing that irks me about the Confucian side, though I see a value in it, I'm not saying there's no value in that.
Sure, yeah.
But the trouble is, if you do the form and it kills the energy,
right,
that's no bueno.
A stagnation. That's in no adults bueno. Treat the liver.
Let's treat the liver. This is the organ that tries to keep the chi moving in adults if you're not a Chinese medical person.
Yeah.
You know, someone says we need to do points on your liver channel. They're basically saying you're frustrated, pissed off, and stagnant. Because the acupuncturist, like, we need to do some liver points on you. That's what they mean.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think that's the feeling. And, you know, I going back, like, to do, like, these Zen things, it was interesting. I'm glad I did those practices early. Because they had that weird, intuitive kind of experiential aspect to them.
Mm-hmm.
That was more like, okay, develop a feeling what it feels like to flow through, whether it's a physical thing, like you were talking about earlier, like a yogi who can feel like how their body flows and the connection of their body and their mind, and they feel that mm-hmm. fluidity there, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or like, you know, how you move through your life, or how you move through treating a patient, or, you know, we're teaching something in some setting. How does that feel spontaneous and natural and like engaging?
Yeah.
That's kind of Zen, you know? You know, there's the old book Flow. You know, the guy went around and he started trying to ask people about, who were very good at things. Like he talked to Michael Jordan while playing basketball. You know, and Michael Jordan would say, you know, I don't know. I go into a space, I go into a certain zone, and I flow, you know? And, you know, Zen tries to get that feeling of what it feels like to flow. Because the probably things will, because if you're Taoist or you're Zen, you say, well, probably shit will turn out better if
right.
I let the things flow. If I try to force it into some structure, that might look good from a certain vantage point, you know. I look at the big picture, I put everybody in their boxes, that looks better if I want to order things that way.
Mm-hmm.
But like for the individual parties involved, you know, this is more of a question of like, can we get things just to flow in the way that like has that spontaneous, natural quality to it, which is
right.
probably more enlightening and enlivening in the end anyways.
Yeah.
Before we totally bounce, can I say one last thing? Because we're not going to go back to this subject matter. We're going to be done with it. What was also was interesting was, you know, there's those books by Christopher Ryan, Sex at Dawn.
So, yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Sex at Dawn and Civilized to Death.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think about his stuff with these things too, especially in the past week when I was thinking about the Taoism and Confucianism stuff, where this must be like a primordial problem. You know, the way he presents it in Sex at Dawn, things didn't used to be this structured.
Mm.
You know, it was much more spontaneous styles of living for people.
When was this?
Well, like before agriculture.
Oh, okay, fine.
Agriculture is the
yeah,
the thorn in the story. in his story. Maybe that's worthwhile doing a whole episode on at some point.
Well, that for that we should, you know, we could do, we should do that with an anthropologist, and we have a couple on call, because it's funny, you know, we were supposed to have Mary Kay on tonight. You know, she's a little under the weather, but hopefully we'll have her on soon. She actually brought that up just the, when I spoke to her the other day on the phone, was the implementation on agriculture changed the shape of how we interact with each other, and how it created changes that were never there before.
It's interesting because they talk about, like, in his book, he talks about people trying to convince those who live, like, in the Amazonian jungle to, like, do stuff. And they're like, what are you talking about? Why would I want to, like, get up at the same time every day and work? I could just go and eat that stuff off the tree. And then I enjoy myself. I play my music. I make love. I go to sleep. I take a nap. Like, what the fuck are you talking about?
Mm-hmm.
They're like trying to convince them, like, no, you need a schedule, you need this and that. And they're like, are you high? Like, what are you talking about? I don't need that. You know. But anyways, that's his position in the book. Whether that's true anthropologically or not, I don't know.
I don't know.
Okay. But, like, you could hear it in the Taoists and the Confucius. They're arguing about this point.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, the tension that I've always recognized, that everyone who studies Chinese culture recognizes this, but, like, something clicked in me. Probably like reading the I Ching again after some years, and then like looking back at Chuangzi, it's like, wow, they really are having this fight that almost like feels like there was some point in history where people decided we're going to make things really structured, and another group of people were like, stop it. And they're fighting about it, you know? And these events would have happened, you know, when these authors were writing, what, like, you know, 3,000 years ago or something like that, mm-hmm. at this point, or whatever the number is exactly. If I'm getting that wrong, I'm wrong, but it's somewhere around that time probably, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you know, there's a conflict happening. We're going to structure everything to make the society fit a certain way. No, this has to be allowed to flow in a more natural way. You're fucking everything up. And they fight over this point. It's interesting. Mm-hmm. Anyways, I just wanted to throw it out there because we probably won't go back to the specific subject, but just maybe to get it out there for you to think about. And I know you do already. And maybe people who are listening who haven't maybe thought about these kinds of things, you know, it's interesting to think about. Yeah.
Yeah. I think the only thing from a meditative point, you do use structure in order to rein in your, you know, what my, I like what, how Andre calls it, your rays of attention, you know, mm-hmm. the various laser beams that your mind is operating within, sending out thoughts to this, thoughts to that, so on and so forth. And that you kind of like, you rein them in. And then eventually they come in, they become much tighter and much more powerful. They become much more bright. So as opposed to like 1,000 flashlights spread out all over the sky, you have like a spotlight, you know, and then the goal would be to have that spotlight spin around, you know, and use a sort of penetrating effect to go back. But you do have to have a method in order to be able to rein in that attention for most things. There's obviously some meditative forms that are just completely open and totally unattached, and people attain ways this way. But most practices that I'm aware of have some form of structure, some form of form, you know, based on karma or whatever you're attracted to, or who knows the difference between those two things anyways, that bring you to a sense of freedom, actually, where you're formless. You know, so it's kind of like
the irony of it, right?
The irony of it. Yeah, exactly.
And that's the interesting thing in like the feeling of it. Again, if I go back to the feeling of it, because I like those things too. And I think we both can have that recognition of form could be good for the expression of energy.
Yes. Yeah.
So if you're going to do musical things, we both love music, playing music, creating music. The form gives the chance for the energy to come through, right?
Yes.
So I suppose the Zen or Taoist critique is don't put the form before the energy though.
Right.
Because that will be stultifying. But if the form becomes a tool that allows you to express the energy, well then that's okay, you know? And I think we agree. I mean,
yes.
And that's a feeling thing in a way too. Because you know, when you get in the zone in the structured meditation, this episode's so fucking funny.
Man, this is wild, bro.
When we get into a lot of the Tibetan meditations are pretty structured.
Yes, very structured.
But it's true that like they begin to develop a certain kind of flow.
Yeah.
That has that quality to it. And you realize, okay, this is energy expressing itself. And the form is just there to help the energy kind of go along.
So now this, and this is what I meant when I was
being imposed from the outside, you know, an overly kind of like oppressive kind of a thing.
Mm-hmm. And this is what I meant by in the treatment room or having a conversation and holding space.
Yeah.
That the form allows the energy to express in that way, you know?
The funny thing about that to me was that immediately sounded Carl Rogers.
Sure.
Sure. Which I would think is very Taoist.
So, but not, you know,
because it has that balance to it or something. It's trying, or not even balance. It has a proper relationship between energy and form.
Yeah, I mean, you can't be you can't be an improvisational musician without knowing music, without having some form, something to play within, you know, to play around with. You have to have some structure. Michael Jordan can't be in free flow unless he understands how to dribble, how to shoot, you know. So there's some, so it's a balance, you know, as so always.
Plays in the offense too, right? In order to know where Scottie Pippen's going to be, if you want to go old school bull stuff, right?
Yeah.
Scottie's going to be on the wing and I could toss him and he'll try to hit that three from the top of the key or something like that. Exactly. You know what I mean?
Yeah. That's right. That's
from behind that top of the key, behind the, you know, the 3-point line towards the top of the key. Yeah. Anyways, that's some basketball shit. But you know, when you, yeah, but I, you know, again, it's this, it's that interesting Taoist Zen-y thing. Like, yeah, you use the form only exists to help the energy express.
Mm-hmm.
That's mm-hmm. sort of the principle, right? Energy mm-hmm. before form. Mm-hmm. Maybe not no form, but the form has to follow the energy. I still think that speaks to me. And
yeah,
I hadn't thought about it in that experiential way, but that is true. You know, that it developed a kind of a feeling. And then maybe I took that feeling into some of the Tibetan meditations or some of the other things, because I knew what it felt like to go samadhi, to go that feeling. And then those Tibetan meditations felt different, you know, mm-hmm. even if they were structured. It was like, I could feel the flow within this because I've been studying flow in the Zen world.
Yeah.
Well, and for, I hadn't thought about this way. Yeah.
You know, for people who don't have a meditation practice, this is why it takes such a long time to develop it, is because you do have to work through some structure to get wherever quote unquote there is. You know what I'm saying? Like, it's the pathway. That's the step-by-step-by-step way. An open focus meditation. And I've been doing this with people a little bit more over the last probably 2 months, is guiding somebody to get to make their focus. I'll just share it. Like, what I do is I'll have them put themselves in a white room, and then I'll have them see a shape on a wall. And then I make that shape as small as possible until they can barely make it out. And I just say, keep your focus on that shape. And usually I'll say a square or triangle or a, you know, plane, just something there. Keep staring. And after some time, not that long, because I know people's attention is hard to do this, I'll say, feel your attention tightening. Feel the aperture of your mind squeezing down on this form. Okay. Instantly, you're on the top of a mountain and it's blue skies all around you. Feel 360 degrees. Relax. Open your mind. Open. See as much as you can, and then understand there's more behind you that you can't see, but feel that, you know, bring your feeling and your vision together. And people really can, they get super relaxed when that happens. And I feel like it's because they've gone through the pinhole, you know, they've concentrated deeply, and now they have that kind of release. It's, if we can go back a year and a half or so, it's a baby Shengasm. You know, we got tension that builds up, and then it's, oh yes. Yes.
Like, kind of like releases itself into the big blue sky.
Right? That's right. Yeah. Like a sperm whale.
Into the big blue sky.
That's right. That's
you
right.
Know, what's interesting about that, kind of funny episode, but what's interesting about that is a very creative way to do it, obviously. So it's, yeah, it's beautiful. Right. But also the idea that it is very Zen.
Mm-hmm.
Because you concentrate, you know, and eventually they say it's something will pop, and then you'll feel the hugeness of this other part of who you are.
Mm-hmm.
So it's an irony of like, you focus on the very, very focused thing, and then it'll go pop. And all of a sudden this other part of you that again is this expansive, big as the sky feeling.
Mm-hmm.
Will appear,
mm-hmm.
You know, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. That's interesting.
Yeah, well, sometimes, Eric, we do a podcast, and sometimes for our listeners, Eric and I are just talking, you know, and today,
I don't know what the fuck this is, but
we're just here, you know, we're just doing our thing.
This is good.
This is great. Good. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, Daniel, we were joking beforehand that Daniel loves spontaneity, and he has.
Totally. And
are you calling yourself a spontaneity hoarder or something like that?
I am a spontaneity hoarder for sure.
Daniel couldn't be more tickled if, like, this shit had nothing to do with any script at all.
No.
This is my favorite episode ever.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think for people learning to do the meditation thing, okay, you work with your mind. I think part of what you're talking about there is people's minds are so anxious, so scattered that you have to do that.
Yeah.
Right. And so otherwise you can't know yourself. You have to focus more to know yourself. Yeah. To be able to
I
see
agree.
Otherwise,
absolutely.
There's all of this distraction. Of course, you can talk about like the dirty water and you let the dirt settle and you can see the clarity, right? I mean, that's the metaphor.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, when you really get practical with people, like, hold on, your mind's all over the place. You're thinking this thing, you're thinking that thing, you're anxious about this one, you're thinking about this political event, you know, whatever. No, focus on this triangle on this wall, right? And let's get that part of your mind or your spirit to focus.
Mm-hmm.
And then you'll get more clarity. And then if you all of a sudden flip the switch, okay, now we're occupying space.
Mm-hmm.
The space like formless meditation, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now you'll feel the hugeness of this other part of who you are. Right, the part that's transcendent of this time and locale, because that's going to kick in, right?
Yes. Yep.
But like, you know, maybe the energy and form thing, maybe this is my closer, I don't know if you have a closer after this, but maybe the energy and form thing is, it's still based on a feeling somehow, right? There's a feeling of like the energy, the quality of things, and the form is service. And maybe that's what bums people out sometimes about the meditation thing, is they feel like it's too tight.
The rigidity.
I feel too tight. I have to concentrate on this thing really perfect and that thing really perfect. And it has to be all, maybe there's a perfectionism that some people might feel, you know, I didn't do it good enough, or I have to really force myself to concentrate in this certain way. But, you know, when you do this for a while, you realize, no, you got to work with your mind and let it flow a little bit. You can't force it. It doesn't want to be forced.
Yeah.
Kind of like the old Zen pictures about the kid trying to like, lead the bull along, you know, like you put the little noose around the bull.
And,
yeah, you try to pull on the bull will just like rip its horns back. You know, it's not going to let you do that.
Correct.
You have to pull along with the bull. You know, the energy and the mind have to flow together in that way. Yeah. I wonder if maybe that's what bums people out. It feels oppressive then.
And
that
people,
too confusion.
They're right. That is too confusion. And I also think people spend, you know, they watch a TV screen or their phones. It's a box. They drive a car. It's a box. You sit in a house. It's a box. You work at a cubicle or wherever, you know, in an office. That's a box. Your time is like, you got to do this at this specific time. And you got to be here and you have responsibilities. And now you got to sit here and follow this prompt. That's difficult.
Yeah.
You know, it's just you're adding more frustration to the pot, and the pot is already overflowing with frustration. So, it's a big ask.
Yeah, it's an interesting problem. You know, it's an interesting problem, and then you got to do it right, and it has to be perfect, and I have to like force my mind to do this thing, all those things.
Mm-hmm.
It's a little sidebar point, but Gelug Rinpoche, it wasn't like his main point. Obviously, he wanted people to concentrate, but I remember him saying at one point like, when Americans try to do these Tibetan meditations where you're visualizing all the different colors and the mandalas, whatever, they get so in, like, they get so into every single little detail.
Yeah.
You know, that it gets painful for them, you know, like I have to do every little tiny little thing perfect. And he said, like, sometimes for Tibetans, you just see like a big, big red blob.
Right. Right.
It's okay. Sometimes, you know, they'll clarify as it goes along. You don't have to force the mind so much and try to torture it or something.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because otherwise it'll feel bad. And then you obviously, then the energy and form is all wrong and you won't want to do this stuff.
Correct. Right. Now you're not, now you're not even in the game.
There's no joy. Yeah.
You got to be in the game if you want to play.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right, my brother. Well, thanks. I mean, this is like,
it has nothing to do with like anything that would happen.
No.
How the relationships. We'll get to that episode next time.
But
this was good.
Yeah. No, I enjoyed this for sure. This is, It's fun. Well, Eric, as always, thank you for being on the journey with me, my friend. And to our audience, you know, whoever's with us, as they say at the end of most longer videos, congratulations on having the attention span of a top 5th percentile, because most people don't have that kind of ability to stick with something to the end. But I think actually we gave some really good gems at the end. For those of you who are still with us, thank you for listening. We do appreciate it. We appreciate the love and the feedback. You know, make sure like, subscribe, hit the bell icon. If you're on the YouTube, get notifications hooked up. It doesn't cost you anything. It helps out in the algorithm for sure. And it also helps out for you to share our work if you find it useful, or even if you don't find it useful and you want to spam someone's inbox with things that will annoy them, you know, spam with us, man. That's cool. We could be spam. You know, in one part of the country, spam is disliked highly. And yet in other parts of the country, it's like a delicatessen. Or
Delicacy.
Delicacy. Whatever. It could be a Spam delicatessen. I don't know. You
just
know,
go right into it. Yeah. Exactly.
Every sandwich is a Spam sandwich. So, you know.
This yeah. is like doesn't have shit to do with anything, but I remember going to this Vietnamese restaurant and the woman was so like proud to show us the food, the people who were there. So we ordered some noodle dish and all it was noodles with like a can of Spam on the top.
Ooh.
Put it down like she just like was presenting like you know, Queen Elizabeth, like with the most, you know, refined delicacies to the kingdom. It was like, what the fuck is this? It was, that's my last Spam experience, but it literally was still in the shape of the can, just like,
well,
on a thing of cold noodles. And she went like, here you go, you know, like, and we were like, okay.
Sometimes you get lucky, man. Memory. Sometimes you get lucky.
But
yeah.
But that wasn't one of those times. Yeah.
That is not. Anyways, thank you everybody for tuning in. For Eric, this is Daniel. We'll catch you guys in the next one. Peace.
I want you to get together. I want you to get together.